Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to Oscar-winning production designer Paul D. Osterberry about his work on The Color Purple.
Hey, Jackson. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Not bad. Thanks.
Excellent. How was the premiere last night?
Oh, it was great. It was great. It was great to see it. I hadn't seen it on that big a screen. You know, it's the Academy Cinema, so it's like massive screen with almost 1,000 people. So it was really great to see it in that environment. Good sound and obviously great picture. So, and with a nice audience. So very good. It was exciting. Yeah.
One of my favorite films of the year by far.
Fantastic. Oh, you've seen it already. Great.
I saw it on, I think it was Monday. Nice. And I have been waiting for this since they started announcing the casting of this. I have missed every opportunity to see The Color Purple whenever it came around, either on Broadway or when it came to my neck of the woods. And I'm so happy this is now sort of cemented in cinema and people can watch this as many times as they possibly want, because I love the music of it. And now to have it on film is just absolutely spectacular.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And Blitz added to the music too. You know, he brought in, Kev Moe for blues and, you know, various people for gospel and the three different genres, jazz as well. And so just elevated the music as well, because, you know, he is a musician first, and he was very, at the very beginning when I first met him, that's really what he talked about. You know, he'd been working on the music for several months before I even started, and that helped us, you know, get going, and the movie's sort of broken down into different, slightly different music styles as well, you know, as we progress. So it was pretty great to have that from him as a musician before, as well as a movie maker, obviously.
Yeah. And I'm just curious, first off, I mean, what was your familiarity with, I mean, The Color Purple in general, whether it was just the book or the musical itself?
Well, I hadn't seen the musical, and it wasn't available online or anything like that. I was working in London on The Flash, and one of my PAs, she loved the musical. So she's going on and on about it when I said I had the interview. And I still didn't know anything about the musical, but I thought that's okay, because, you know, I'd never done a musical anyway. I mean, the Broadway musical, I mean, I hadn't seen it, but I haven't done a film musical. But I thought, you know, it's fine. I wanted to listen to what Blitz wanted to do with it rather than the previous iterations. And of course, the book I read again before speaking with Blitz. And I had seen the Spielberg movie ages ago, but I kind of wanted to, again, sort of keep it aside for the beginning and just develop with Blitz what his version was, what his vision was beforehand. And then eventually I did, strangely enough, I did see it on a, it was on a plane when I was in Georgia. So I thought, you know what, this is, you know, I think it's fate. I should be watching it. So I watched it again, but I was well into the film at that point, working on the film. So it was nice to see. And then I realized there was a couple of things that we consciously chose to change and also embrace, which was great. Cause, you know, obviously it's a great film and a great book. You know, we had a lot of stuff. It was a bit intimidating. We had a lot of stuff ahead of us, you know, that we had to follow. So
But I mean, you have Oprah and Steven Spielberg as producers, so that's a step in the right direction. But can we talk about that meeting, first few meetings with Blitz, and sort of establishing what that tone was going to be, and what his vision for the film looked like at the beginning?
Well, for, you know, obviously, you know, you've heard Blitz probably speak about it. You know, we're able to live vicariously through Celie's imagination. You know, it's her escapism is through her mind and through her imagination. So, but because you're doing that as well as doing a period film, we talked about being really grounded in reality to start with. So of course we started heavily with research to make sure we were correct in the various periods. And what was very nice, for once in my 30-year career, we were actually shooting in a location. We were shooting in Georgia, which was the setting of the film, Georgia. Now, granted, we were based in Metro Atlanta, and we were supposedly in, you know, rural Georgia, and actually in this version, in the film script, we were in coastal rural Georgia, so we weren't anywhere near the coast. But we did end up shooting, going and scouting and shooting along the coast and near Savannah and south of Savannah to Jekyll Island. But getting back to your question, basically we wanted to start with reality first before we... So then it's more fantastical and more amazing when she gets into these, we can go diverge into these various things with her mind, you know, starting, you know, I mean, the record player was one of the early ones, you know, where the giant gramophone. So I think if we just concentrated on the fantastical, magical realism bits first without basing it in reality, it wouldn't have been as successful, I think. So that was what we really started talking about. And again, the music, like I said, we started talking about the music. He didn't want, one thing that Blitz did say right from the beginning, when we were looking for Mister's house, which is a very important location, was he didn't want any antebellum style. In the Spielberg movie, there was some shots at the front of that house. It was quite a grand house with the big columns, you know, antebellum style columns. But most of it was played, I think, consciously on the rear side, which was less foreboding or less of that image, sort of architectural style. And we didn't want to have... Liz did not want to have that, and I didn't want to have that style in our film either. So we chose still a very fair-sized home for us for shooting, but it was more of a modest style. So,
And I am curious. I mean, how did you approach it different? I mean, obviously we're talking about the creative aspect and sort of the fantastical aspect too. But when approaching a movie musical versus
Regular period movie. Yes, yeah. Well, you know, like I said, this was my first time, and it was also Dan Lauston, the DP, who I've worked with before. He's a good friend of mine. It was his first time doing a musical. But that, you know, there are times when I'm first time doing like a Roman movie or something like that. It's all about doing some research and talking to people about things. I did a good friend of mine as a set decorator, and he did Chicago and Nine and all these things with John Meyer. Gordon Sim is his name, and I chatted to him because I was curious to know what the stages were, and I was a bit nervous because it was quite rigid, you know. All the props had to be sourced really early, the sets had to be really, really well thought out to accommodate the choreography early, and then they didn't really change, you know, and it was quite rigid. Whereas luckily, there's many ways to do it, but in our terms, with Fatima Robinson doing the choreography, she was very, very flexible. She wasn't so rigid in what the props were. We were okay with decent facsimiles. We always taped out the layouts of the sets for her and her team. And, you know, I always then, in my mind, would think, obviously, layers, you know, because you have lots of dancers, you want to see the ones in the back. I wanted to step it up high. These are just things I just figured visually would be a smart thing to be able to accommodate. And then I was just more nervous about, you know, our kind of locations. The Juke Joint in particular was one of these really run down, kind of made with scrap materials, scavenged materials. And so I wanted the floorboards to be all warped and irregular sizes and everything a bit hodgepodge. I was a bit nervous, providing that with not like a nice smooth floor for all the dancing, because it's quite a vigorous dance in there and people are on the floor and being dragged around on it. But Fatima said, no, it should be fine. As long as there's no splinters and things like that, you know, we'll accommodate, you know, and they were incredibly adapt, you know, they could adapt very quickly to the things we gave them. You know, we started with a layout and we kind of stuck to it. But of course, as your set dressing comes in, Larry Diaz would bring in certain pieces like, oh, that's an amazing piece. Let's put it there in the corner. And then it can be used as a element to dance with or off or whatever as well. It was flexible. It was quite flexible, actually. And I was pleased about that because, you know, films are always an evolving thing. You know, you think one thing at the very beginning and you go along, and as you're coming to fruition, you realize that, oh, you know, we can improve it by doing this, or, oh, we got a great angle over here. And so it was great that we weren't so locked in as I thought we might have been for traditional choreography.
And one scene in particular that you slightly touched on that I am curious to ask you about is Suge's entrance into the jukebox joint. And I'm curious, I mean, that is just such a stunning entry.
One of my favorites. That is something that came, the germ came from the Spielberg film. When Harpo was doing his juke joint in that film, there was a barge pulled on a cable, and they brought they were bringing a big piano. It was kind of a nice image of this small barge with a big piano being brought across the water into the juke joint. And that kind of stuck with me. And so when we, you know, we'd already designed this, you know, or we knew we were going to do this swamp thing, but I thought, well, that's a great entrance, you know, or fantastic entrance on the water using one of those pool barges. And symbolically, you know, in that film, they were bringing the music, the source of music, the piano in the day. And I thought it would be so much better if, you know, Taraji's character comes in kind of like, you know, Cleopatra down the Nile or something, and this amazing thing, and Francine's costume, you know, with that vibrant red, and then Dan Lawson had this sort of steel blue color in the haze, you know, the moonlight was kind of this blue, so the red really pops against it, and it was a really great image. And of course, when she gets into the juke joint, because most of the film is quite earthy tones anyways, right? So, but that's a really, there's not much color in the scavenged wood and everything of the juke joint, except for the costuming, of course. So her headdress and her costume really popped in that whole scene in there as well. So it was pretty great. It was fun. And the swamp was difficult to achieve because, you know, a swamp is in the middle of water. We were in Savannah looking at real swamps. But I was at the mercy of the rain, you know, for the levels of the river. I mean, yeah, it was a river going up and down in the swamp. And, you know, we had to do it. We had to be three stages in that particular set. We had the sort of found shack that the grandfather gave him that he was renovated into the house for Harpo. And then we were renovated again into the Harpo's juke joint. We went the reverse order, the biggest first. So we found a place near Covington, Georgia, that was a fishing hunting place, you know, it was an old farm that was converted into a plantation that was converted into this, and so they had dammed several little bits of valley and forest, so it was man-made, so we could unplug it, drain out a certain amount, plug it back up when the water got to a point where we could access the area that I'd chosen. I surveyed, and we cut down some trees to give us room to stick the juke joint in, and then we put swamp mats down, and then we built it all up. And then we fill it right back up again. And then after that, we start with the biggest one first, which is the juke joint. And then we had to work from barges and from inside to pair it back to the original stage. We went in reverse order, but it was a difficult thing to do, but it was well worth it to have it in that setting. Cause I think it was a really lovely entrance for her.
Oh, absolutely. It will be imprinted in my brain probably for many years to come. But I'd also love to dive into, Seeley's Pants Shop and how that sort of, and the original sort of grocery store, and just how that was sort of constructed, because I mean you have two absolutely beautiful choreographed pieces in there that will, another sort of just momentous things that will stick in my brain, and I'm just curious how that was all sort of conceived and constructed, because it's just so wonderful, and I think the pops of color that were brought in with the clothes really brought so much to the earthy sort of tones that you're speaking to. And I'm so fascinated by that shop.
That was a tricky one. Again, like the juke joint and this one, you know, you think of, I sort of think of musicals with having big expansive sets for these dance numbers. Whereas, you know, that doesn't really suit, obviously when we get into her fantasies, they can be more fantastic and grand, but these ones had to be grounded in a real size space. They were quite small. And the hardware store, you know, and then became Fancy Pants store. We needed, obviously, we had an exterior that we had to tie to. So you can only go so big, you know, based on the exterior storefronts. And so we went a little bit bigger than the existing exterior. But when designing we started with the hardware store, and it got converted later on. There was a time where we actually thought of a bigger, we went into some fantasy, and then we ended up keeping it real and keeping it all within that space. So then I had to think again, this layering, which I mentioned to you, obviously there's the big counters that we could walk on, but in the hardware store at the very back, we had a loft storage area for during the hardware store version of it that I knew later I could put these doors. Well, I thought about putting these doors on and having a second layer for the background dancers when they kick open, or we had them rigged to pop open all simultaneously. And have that nice layering in the back, so you could see all the various dance moves. And of course, Larry Diaz, set decorator, had to make, again, because the space is really small, he made all these sort of Victorian kind of rolling racks for all the pants to be on that could be moved around and used as props for the dancing successfully, you know, when they pulled apart the dancing, they everything was on wheels in that set. Basically, the sewing machine stations were all on wheels, all that just to give the freedom again for the performance. Because it was, like I said, it was an evolution. We didn't have all those props when they were designing that performance necessarily. And the other thing for Dan Lauston for lighting, all the other stores on our street had just fixed awnings that would obviously shade the front windows. And Dan likes single source lighting, like a heavy source coming through the windows, very contrasty. He's definitely not afraid of it. And so we made the awning outside a retractable one, again, from research that mm-hmm. Larry and I had found, that you show these ones, you pull on pulleys and they retract up or come down depending on the sun. And so that allowed the freedom for Dan to have it high or open to let light in when he needed, or cut it back when he didn't. Again, to emphasize some of this dancing, nice backlit. When we looked to the front, it was nicely backlit, big backlit sources from there. So,
Yeah, no, I've had the great fortune of chatting with Dan.
Great.
Not this project, but just in general, in terms of his process, and the single source lighting was a point of our conversation in the past. So that now that illuminates quite a bit in terms of that.
Both in this one and the previous one in the juke joint, there's a moment where the dance, it's more natural lighting, more realistic lighting, and then there's a point where the music changes and it flicks into more stage theatrical lighting, and that's when, like I said, the upper level opens. There's some backlights behind those dancers up there, which is much more stagey, much more Broadway-ish like. And again in the juke joint, when they flip down the power thing goes into darkness, and then there's this crazy shaft of light coming from the upper decks of that really sensual dance inside in the juke joint before, again, Harpo plunks back the light and comes back to reality again. The lighting changed quite heavily there, but when I had to allow for that within the set design, to allow for that other theatrical lighting as well as the natural lighting.
And then this might be more simplistic, but something that's just as striking to me is the final scene in the film where they're all surrounded
the tree.
And I'm curious how that sort of sequence came to be, because it's just absolutely stunning when you first get that shot in there. And I mean, leaving that moment, it's just
a gorgeous tree. The script actually was written, it was supposed to be in a field. It was the field of lilies, like obviously the field of flowers from the Spielberg film was the way it was written. But of course, that's, you know, midday sun, heavy sun, and just a few, you know, and it was scripted as a linear long table in the original draft out in a field. And that would have been beautiful too, on a hill with a view or vista or something like that at sunset or something. But of course, the reality is we're shooting all day, and we open when we, at the beginning of this, we discovered the beautiful live oak tree with the girls doing their patty cakes in it. And it was nice to bookend the film. I suggested anyway, let's think about this tree. It's that the tree of life. The ending of the story is all the friends and now family gathering, that, you know, we find the family from her lost children from that are come from Africa with her grandkids. It's like it's a family tree. And that was her happy point at the beginning with the two of them together and playing patty cakes in the tree. Why don't we just bookend it and set it under this tree? Again, for Dan as well, you know, we have this nice circular table around the trunk. It's all sheltered from the you know, the high sun. And then, you know, the hero shot obviously was a nice, like, rear lit, you know, towards the end of the day, beauty shot. And, you know, we did a rendering. I mean, it's funny, when I did a little presentation recently for the ADG, and I had the little rendering smaller in the photograph, and it's very hard to tell which one's which, because because I took a picture of the tree obviously first before we did the rendering. So the tree itself is the same, but the lighting, you know, it worked out really, really, really well. It was a beautiful ending, actually. And a very fitting one, I think, you know, that was quite symbolic, that tree.
And then one more thing that sort of just came to mind in terms of some of the pieces. I mean, when you're on the beach, I don't even know how to describe them, but were those sort of
dead trees?
Yeah, the dead trees. Were those already on the beach? Did you have to construct those? Because I just think the choreography itself with the two girls is just so beautiful, and it just it kind of goes back to that sort of patty cake child-esque like sort of world. And I'm just curious how that was constructed or if it was already there.
It was actually a find because the script had written clifftop. There was a scene on the clifftop, but of course there are no clifftops in Georgia originally. So then I obviously, you know, locations are key in this kind of movie. It's a very location-based movie. And I Googled, you know, at the point when I was doing this, I was still not on the film and I was in England still. So I was just Googling beaches of Georgia and I came across this called Driftwood Beach or something in Jekyll Island. And there was a couple of pictures of some of these dead live oak trees. It's through erosion. You know, those trees were beautiful and they're on the coast and then the water has been coming in. And so they've died. And I just thought it was a nice counterpoint to the beautiful tree that they had with all the leaves. Originally, I thought it was a nice counterpoint. I mean, I know that was a lovely dance with the girls in it, but originally I thought, oh, it's a nice place when we introduce Mister because we've got the fully leaf tree and then it's a bit sinister. Then you see, you know, he's coming across really nice and sweet, but he's, you know, it's kind of not a very pleasant thing if you think about the age difference and what he's saying in there. So I thought it was a nice way to introduce Mister in that when he's trying to seduce Nettie, you know, he's trying to, he's flirting with Nettie. But then in the end, we used it again with the two girls dancing. And it was just a beautiful setting. And I'm very fortunate we were able to use it. It took a little bit of convincing because it's a park. So,
well, yeah. It's absolutely beautiful. And final question for you. I mean, what do you take away from working on this project in particular?
Oh, you know, first of all, my first musical, it was a wonderful experience to work on. That's a big takeaway. It was just, you know, Blitz, you know, it's a second film. It was great to work with someone who really, you know, let us go. And we just think outside the box a little bit. He was coming from his musical background. It was just a really nice experience. You know, it was very, we Dan Blitz and I had a very intimate relationship where we could just talk about things. We have dinner at his house and it was a really friendly and creative environment. And that was a really nice takeaway. It was a nice working experience.
Well, that's lovely to hear. And I have to thank you again for chatting with me today and just creating such a beautiful film that I know I will be revisiting many, many times in the near future because it's spectacular. So I have to thank you again.
I'm glad. Thank you too.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery, but a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.